Hi, hello. We have a fun episode of the Dunker Spot planned for you. For the first time this season, we go to the Dunker Spot mailbag, dunkerspot@yahoo.com, answer some awesome questions, and then we had a conversation with Gary Payton II. We talked defense, we talked screening, we talked skateboarding. So tap in, have some fun. We hope you enjoy the episode. Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of the Dunker Spot. We are part of the Yahoo Sports Network. I am your host, Nakias Duncan, and joining me as always is my co-host, the always excellent Steve Jones Jr. Steve, hello, sir. How are you?
Feeling good, feeling great. I'm happy to be here. I'm excited to be here. Thank you, everyone, for embracing your bounce. I'm ready to talk about basketball. I'm ready to get in that bag.
Get in that bag is insane. We are having our first mailbag episode of the season. So a quick thank you to everyone that sent in questions. As always, if you have basketball thoughts, driving home from work, you're just bored around the house, doing some chores, whatever the case may be, watching the game, something pops for you, email us at dunkerspot@yahoo.com. Dunkerspot@yahoo.com. Let's dig in because we got some fun stuff here. First, a few from Twitter. So thank you to those who sent questions in from Twitter as well. This one coming from Frilly Mob Cap. I hope I got that right. If it's Frilly Mo B Cap, I'm going to be really upset. But anyway, thank y'all for being two of the very best in the game. I would love to hear a discussion about if either of you have observed a common thread between all the teams that have taken a leap this year, whether it manifests through culture or if it's been unique to each team.
Well, if we're talking leap, that puts the Pistons in that category, right? That puts the Raptors in that category. Thunder and Machine, Lakers be in that category. Denver, Houston's not really. Houston? Question mark? Upward inflection?
Like, I don't know if Houston's a leap. I don't know if Denver's a leap. Like, I started at the same place as you. I'm going to toss it right back to you. And I was like, I need to figure out who the breakout teams are for me. And so I also had the Pistons, the Raptors. I had the Heat just because of what the offense has been. I had the Spurs. It was naturally just big jump in the standings. And I had the Suns. The team that I struggled the most with, I guess going back to the Southeast Division, I didn't know what to do with the Hawks or the Magic. I ended up on no on the Magic, ended up no on the Hawks. But like the Hawks, could they have a strong argument to also be here?
They just got beat by a lot of points about the Washington Wizards. Let's leave them alone for a little bit. to the question from Frilly Mob Cap, I think the common thread for me with those teams is probably an identity. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't want to just stamp the culture word buzzword on top of it, but just an identity and a buy-in and an understanding of who they are. And you see them as they've progressed throughout the season, you see them play with more belief in what they're doing. Mm-hmm. So with Detroit, we are defending, we are physical. And the more they have success with it, the more you see them, okay, we're tagging everyone who rolls. We're being physical with every cutter. You see more of it. When you're talking about the Raptors bouncing back from a rough start, defense wasn't where it was. Now they understand that what they have to do defensively. Now you see them execute it more. You see more pre-rotation. You see more communication. You see more denials. Thinking about, obviously, Miami, more empowered within the offense, understanding, okay, comfort levels with getting to drive and kick, clearing aside, opening things up. I think that, to me, is kind of the common thread. Mm-hmm. Is just they know who they are. They know what they want to get to. And they continue to get to it in different ways.
Okay, I like that answer. I think for me, I also thought of just the general culture / identity piece of it all. Like all of them have a thing. And as much talk as there's been about Miami and the offense and lack of screens, et cetera, like they have just been a top five, top six defense all year long. And we know Eric Spoelstra lends his hat on that. I remember tweeting out over the offseason, I think, in 17 years or entering year 18, but it's 13 top 10 defenses in 17 years for Eric Spoelstra with a whole lot of different personalities and personnel, which is insane to me. But either way, there's that. And I do think, as I was trying to dig, okay, like what's different statistically between these teams in addition to culture piece, establishing identity or whatever. A couple of things that I was looking at offensive rebounding. Has there been a shift there? Because it has been more of that league-wide. It's like, well, not really. Like, Phoenix is doing it to a higher degree than what they were. The Raptors are doing it to a higher degree. The Heat still pretty much no on that front. Like, the Spurs kind of been up and down, especially with Wemby out. So it's like, okay, there's not really anything consistent there. We'll note that all but one of the five teams that I mentioned earlier, the Pistons, the Raptors, the Heat, the Spurs, the Suns, all of them but one, Phoenix, were outside of the top half of the league in half-court offense. I think the Suns were ninth in half-court offense. They were awful defensively. But, you know, when you have Devin Booker and Kevin Durant and Bradley Beal, like, you do just have that. But all of them have been pretty good offenses this year. Zooming out, all five of these teams are top 10 defenses per cleaning the glass. Miami was the only one in the top 10 last year, though a little bit of fudging there. Detroit was 11th, Toronto was 14th. But, like, seeing them lean into the defense and all of them having strong defenses, I guess, would be the easiest through line that I have. And, like, they all have a baseline level of activity or funk to them. If you want to get deeper in the weeds, like, we've talked about the Raptors and their full court pressure and their general activity level. We just had a segment about the Hawks and their general activity level defensively. The Heat is more versatility than anything. Like, they are very active helpers. They'll send it from everywhere, but they are back to switching a bunch after they dialed it back the last couple of years to have Bam more in the drop. But you do see the activity with the help there. Phoenix, similar bit with their full court pressure and general activity. So, like, there's another through line. If you want to get deeper into the defense point, go ahead.
Well, no, I was just going to, if you, I had an offense point, what you were doing with your defense point. Well, I was thinking, we also kind of have, I don't want to say breakout, but we have maybe some unexpected contributions or people that have risen in a way that has helped elevate the team. Like, we look at Phoenix, like, Devin Booker's been great, but it's also Grayson Allen's been playing well, and Russell Neal's been involved, and Dylan Brooks has been playing well. So, okay, that elevates that portion. We have the defense. We're good. Victor Wembanyama has been Victor Wembanyama. On top of the system they have, because they've been able to win when he's out. But hey, that guy really makes things a lot better for us. Mm-hmm. Brandon Ingram in Toronto. Hey, we can just kind of make some of these shots when some of these possessions go sideways. So I wonder if that also, Norman Powell, transition, whatever you need, I will knock this down. Like, how Cade Cunningham, Jalen Durant, like, how much is that, that can help elevate a team where, okay, we have a thing that we didn't necessarily have on this side of the ball last year, and we can lean on this.
I like that. I think even zooming up to your overall, like, empowerment point, I think you can kind of see that with everyone. Like, Jalen Duren, as we've talked about, and you have been super high on him, like, it's not just he's a good screener and roller. Like, we started seeing more of the elbow stuff last year when they just sprinkle in random elbow flashes in the middle of possessions. And now we have this self-creation jump. It's like, oh, snap. Well, if he can get Cade open and everybody else open, he can get offensive rebounds. And then on top of that, you can just get on the ball from 16 feet. He faces up. He hits you in the chest. And his defender's flying back 5 feet. That's kind of different. You already mentioned the Toronto of it all, the Miami of it all. They're all whole offensive thing. Wimby getting better, but it's also what Dylan Harper was doing before he got hurt. Stephon Castle taking the leap. Harrison Barnes has just quietly been very good for them. Like, Keldon Johnson's been good, mostly in a reserve role for San Antonio. So, like, everyone has their kind of bits. I like that. That got the wheels turning. I like that, Steve. Trying to think, is there anything else I would add to this one that we haven't hit on yet? I don't think so.
But, I mean, just quickly to put a bow on it, usually it is going to manifest through not just culture, but just what is the, like, what is the coach wanting this team to do? Mm-hmm. What do they do every single night? Do the players believe in that? Are they now holding themselves accountable within that? Is that success building towards something? And you kind of have that early success, and now you can kind of take that belief and kind of ride it throughout the season.
I like that. Good stuff. Good stuff. Thank you for the question. This next couple is going to come from No Clue Is the Best. First question, do you think we will see more zone defense to counter the increasing prevalence of the drive and kick / read and react style of offenses that value constant movement?
More? Not sure. Because here's my thought process. Zone is one of those forever floating concepts that hangs around, and some teams use it for different reasons. So I guess my short answer would be yes. Like, it's not going to go away. Mm-hmm. I don't see a world where teams don't mix in zone to try and slow teams down, to try and take away, as you mentioned, the automatic reads, to try and take away the tempo and get a team to think and try and, you know, take some time off the clock. Mm-hmm. Here's the thing. The more that teams throw zone out, the more teams have reps on it. And so if you take a look at a team like Oklahoma City, who I think, to the question that was asked from No Clue Is the Best, OKC was the team originally that had a lot of that drive and kick and some of the read and react before they kind of just decided we could do everything offensively. Mm-hmm. But zone was the way to kind of get them into either thinking, slowing down, or taking quicker shots. Now you look at how the Oklahoma City Thunder treat zone this year. Teams evolve the more you throw it at them. And so it's not always going to be a forever answer. It can be a very interesting curveball. Mm-hmm. So I guess it comes down to how good is your zone as a team?
Yeah.
Practice times now are limited. It's not the same as it used to be. So how much have you actually worked on this zone? The key to a zone is being able to stay matched up. And we've seen a lot of teams try to go zone or keep it in their back pocket. Those rests have not looked great. So how much value is it as far as, you know, using it out of a timeout or not? I guess I'm interested to see the evolution and how teams want to use it. Like how many are going to feel like it's a true strength for their defense, like a Houston or a Miami? Like how many are going to feel like they can rotate it in and rely on it? You know, how many are going to use it just as a curveball to try and throw a team off? And then how many are going to use it for, oh my gosh, nothing is working, we have to do something type beat?
Yeah, like I think as I was thinking through this one, and again, another good question, like my initial thought was yes, but then I also had the same thought that you had, like there's going to be more of this, but then more teams are going to get to play against this, and thus efficiency is going to rise likely. And so looking up the zone numbers earlier today, just to prep for the pod, it's like, okay, it certainly feels like we're staying zone. Like we've talked about Miami before, like Portland's thrown out some fun zone looks with their smaller units this year. Like a lot of teams are sprinkling it in. You mentioned Houston as well. And so league wide, zone has been played on about 3.1% of total possessions so far this year. That is the highest in the, you know, formerly Second Spectrum, but Genius Sports database that they have going back to 2020, 2021 in this case. So highest that has ever been. This is also the first year among those six that offenses are generating over a point per possession against zone. It's very barely over one, but it kind of goes into your overall point. Like, okay, yeah, more of this is happening. Teams are also kind of getting better at this. And like you look at some of the fan-based conversations around teams that are running zone. Like as someone that is very heavily in Heat Twitter, like I've seen throughout the years, hey, this is a whole lot of zone from Spo. There's a very loud, I love this. There's a very loud, hey, why we keep doing this? Why can't people guard? Yada, yada, yada. With Houston playing a lot more zone this year than it did last year because they continue to lean into the double big lineup. Houston's been dinged a couple of times in their zone this year. Mentioned Portland. Portland's been dinged in that zone. Chicago just got them not too long ago when they went to it. So, like, there is kind of an ebb and flow. Like, I think the secondary thoughts I had with this, one, you already mentioned, just who's going to sprinkle in is like we're coming out of a timeout. It's going to do it for a possession or two, and then we're going to get out of here, et cetera. I did have the general thought bubble, as we've had some coaching changes over the last 2 or 3 years, I feel like we have fewer of the we are never running zone ever type coaches in the league at this point. And okay, like, I wonder if that, not even saying it as a negative, but I'm just saying,
okay.
I want to be clear. This is not like a criticism from me, but I'm saying literally stylistically, philosophically, like there have been head coaches that are like, no, the zone is just not going to be in the bag for us. We may go from like drop to switching or drop to more aggressive pick and roll coverage, but we're not going to tap the zone button. I think as we get more coaches that are willing to do that, I think the overall like league average is going to rise just by default with that kind of thing. So it kind of goes back to my initial answer of, yes, I think we're going to see more zone, but I don't think it's the answer.
Why you take a shot at Tom Thibodeau and Coach Michael Malone?
It's not a shot.
Because who else was you talking about?
Those are two that did not like to press the zone button very often. And this is also Tibbs' very good basketball coach. And Coach Michael Malone is literally a champion. That's why I'm very clear to note, this is not criticism. This is just literally they do not want to do this. And so if the question is about zone volume, getting two coaches that don't want to do it, yeah, we're probably going to see more. That's the only point that I was making.
He cleaned that up, baby. Let's go.
That was my earnest bit. I'm not doing this with you. To the second question, while we're still on defense, from No Clue is the best. Is there a place for college-style presses that are primarily designed to control tempo in the NBA?
I mean, we've seen teams go zone to press 2-2-1 to a 2-3, or you know, full court man-to-man to a 2-3. We've seen that kind of action happen.
Miami.
I don't necessarily think it's going to be a consistent presence because, like, I don't know how exotic it'll get, like college, but we'll keep seeing teams try to find ways to get teams to start their sets later and drain the clock. The thing you have to see is offenses have counters. So it's not the set, like, and I'm old, but like, it's not the set, hey, we need to bring the ball off the court. We need to have one person at this elbow and another person at this elbow. We run this press pick. Well, you have two people back there, so we're going to press you and then trap as soon as you hit this one person. It's not like that. You see in today's game in the NBA, if you try and deny like a Jalen Brunson or a point guard, they just point to someone else and be like, throw them the ball. And so that's kind of like the point of teams having different people who can initiate. So, okay, you took a denial, whatever, get it. And we'll get into our sets and we'll run it and I'll get it on the second side, or a bit more bigs. Like they run delay action. So top of the key, but hit them at half court, make it up.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know if we'll get to that exact thing. Now I'm a little triggered because now I'm remembering practicing some of those college presses and just like, well, I got to trap and then get back to the middle. I got to deny the middle and then I got to get back. No.
All right. Well, I will take it from here. I will say, Miami's already sprinkling this stuff in. Portland's already sprinkling this stuff in. Brooklyn already sprinkled some of this stuff in. So like in a literal sense, there's a place for it. I just, to Steve's point, like, I don't think it could be a foundation for you. Like, even as Portland, Brooklyn over the last 2 years have been two high, like, backcourt pressure teams in the league, like, they don't do it literally every possession. And so, like, I don't think you can get to a point to where this is what we do flat out. Because there are counters, and as we will continue to have more conversations about players getting hurt in general regular season maintenance and how spaced out and fast the game is and the strain on the body, et cetera. In a literal sense, I don't think you can do that as a foundation in the NBA at the very least. There's just too much space to cover. These players are too good. It's a lot of strain. I don't know if it becomes like a foundational tool, but like we already see some of the elements in the league today. So there's
You also have to look at some of the teams in the lineup and the personnel they have. How many of them are actually going to press? Which teams are pressing to just literally please bring the ball up slower, or how many teams have the Andrew Nembhard of the universe where you're not going to have a good time? Asar Thompson, you're not going to have a good time. Amen Thompson, you're not going to have a good time. So I think it kind of varies.
Yeah, I feel you. And just quickly on that front, in terms of overall backcourt pressure possessions per game, it has risen in each of the last six seasons, 20.4 in 2020, 2021, then the 22.2, then 22.8. then 26.1, big jump to 33.4 last year. We're over 40 per game this year, league-wide. So we continue to keep tabs on what that's going to look like and just the overall strain and productivity of it all. So
you love this backcourt pressure point, man.
No, I'm just saying. This is, hey, we got to keep an eye on things. That's all I'm saying. But let's get to our final Twitter question that we have. This one coming from Gino Don't Lie. What's the Gino specific? Well, I mean, we've seen some of those interceptions thrown. I don't know, man. But anyway, this is an unrivaled question. Gino asks, which players are you most excited to see grow their game or try new things that are available in the 3-on-3 unrivaled format? Also, is there room in the current dynamic on their WNBA team to fully realize their expanded bag?
Interesting. Love the questions. I think Unrivaled is a great opportunity for players to work on their game in a competitive setting. And I know some people are like, well, this 3-on-3, you can't do that on 5-on-5. 3-on-3 is a great way to get better. And you have more space, of course, so you have to be more compact when it's 5-on-5. But you have more wiggle room to try different things, to work on your game, to get your footwork right, to have to defend in space. That's a lot of the value for me. I love playing 3-on-3 because, okay, I have to defend. There's so much space, and I have to get clamps. But you have to work to self-create. You have to work to move around the ball. And if you can get some cuts and get yourself open. So there's different things you can do to get yourself better as a player that can apply to 5-on-5. It's not going to be apples to oranges, but it can help. Like I think of the work Angel Reese put in during Unrivaled. I thought a lot of what we saw as the season progressed was, okay, I saw Angel Reese working on the ball handling. Mm-hmm. I saw the comfort handling on the perimeter. I saw the comfort defending in space. You saw Ray Burrell driving. You saw Lexi Hull, the comfort that she had at times trying to turn the corner, get to a mid-range or get to a layup. Some of that you saw on Unrivaled. So I think kind of to tie the thing in, on the last question, the team context is going to mean a lot. But if you have more of a confidence in being able to attack in certain areas of the floor or certain moments, you're gonna be better off for it. Mm-hmm. So I think maybe you don't get to expand, like show the expanded tween hezzy tween, but it's, you know, light clot situations, it could benefit you. Now for me, players I would like to see what Sonya Citron looks like in this environment, and you know what the one-on-one play looks like. I would like to see Veronica Burton and how that defense does things and what it looks like offensively. I have a full list, so I'm going to throw the ball to you because I have a few more.
Oh, man. I love that this is how you started. I echo your sentiments about the general player development context in Unrivaled, so I won't echo those points too heavily, but good stuff there. It's so interesting that you went straight to the like perimeter players, and I know you have a list, you have more, because I started with the bigs. I immediately went to the bigs in this context. As the league gets more, even as the W gets more spaced out, you're seeing more handoff usage and more bigs that can put the ball on the floor, et cetera. My mind immediately went to, hello, Don Malanga. What is this going to look like for you? Ezzie Madbigour, where we've seen the drives, then last year you didn't really get to do all that much in the half court, and now new coach, we're going to see what it looks like. What is Ezzie going to look like? Cam Brink, making the unrivaled debut, finally healthy. Some really interesting drives when she came back last season that she put on film. How is she expanding the on-ball stuff for her? Kiki Iriafin, who just got to the line a bunch, driving. Are we going to see more threes for her in Unrivaled in addition to more of the face-up attacks? I immediately went to the new bigs in this context. I am very excited to see what that looks like and how much handling responsibility they get.
All right, perfect. I had a list of bigs. I knew you would probably take at least 2 to 3 of them. But yeah, I would like to see Alana Smith in this context. What do these drives look like? Mm-hmm. What does the post work look like? I would like to see Maddie Segrist. I think Maddie Segrist is going to get buckets. And then my final one was Lee Yeru.
That's going to be an interesting one.
Yeah. What you going to do with that?
Well, she does have to defend on the other end, but I am curious to see.
Okay, what she's we need to respect bigs, all right? Everyone keeps trying it. You forget the W. Post ups are valuable and they are needed, and we got to respect bigs. We got to respect the Bree Joneses of the world. We got to respect putting in the post and backing someone down to get an easy bucket.
We do.
Stop changing my beautiful game.
Here's the thing. I think those things should be respected because the W is still by and large driven by bigs. We are seeing the current dominance of Asia Wilson right now. But what I am just saying is that like we are seeing pick and roll usage rise. We are seeing like average screen depth rise. You got to be able to guard in space a little bit. You got to be scheme versatile. Like you want that on the high end anyway. But as it gets more important, like, yeah, I think it's important to point out Bree Jones was an all-star. Like for large stretches of Atlanta season last year, she was just their second best player. Like that deserves to be said and highlighted. She was very good. We also got to some fourth quarters and it was, hey, we put in Bree in action. You know what I mean? So that's all I'm saying. Like, I want to see the Lee Yeru threes, the post-ups. We both talked about her improving as a screener last season in Dallas as she was getting consistent playing time post-trade and stuff. Like, there are good things here. She also has to hold up on the other end. As you mentioned, there's more space in the 3-on-3 courts. So, like, if she makes strides there, you feel better about her projection next season. If she can hang in 3-on-3, once you add in 2 more help defenders and condensed space, you feel more comfortable about what that looks like, and you get to see more of the offense pop for her. So, like, yeah, not even going the slander route. I hope it's not coming off that way. But, yeah, I just want to see. Just want to see it. I'm trying to think, is there anybody else I want to shout out here? I guess bouncing back to last year, like the Azaree Stevens of it all is going to be interesting because like, she has always had the skill set and she did have a mini breakout last season. But I do think there is more room for her, more so from the aggression standpoint than anything like skill development wise. I want to see if she takes more ownership because I feel like the usage was kind of inconsistent for her offensively last year during this context. I wonder if they use her more. But no, let's see these bigs. Let's see these bigs.
I'll add Rebecca Allen to the list.
Okay. All right. Thank you again for the Twitter contingent. We now move to our dear personal pal, Ellie. Says, hello, Neckis and Steve of the Dinker Sport Podcast. Wonderful start. Hi, Ellie. I have a basketball question specifically about defense. What are you guys looking for in order to determine whether or not a defense is working both individually and as the team as a whole? Obviously, a higher score is a clue, but like in the players and plays themselves, how do you ascertain defensive effort?
Well, there's a lot of different ways that you can do it. I mean, my mind starts with, hey, are you in a stance? Where are your hands? Are you active with your hands? Are you pressuring or impacting the ball? So is the ball handler comfortable, or are you bothering them to a degree? Footwork, are you ready to slide? You know, are you forcing it, you know, keeping the ball out of the middle of the floor and kind of forcing it baseline? You know, are you ready to adjust? If you're off ball, are you ready to navigate screens? You know, are you getting into a body? Where's your forearm at? Are you showing your hands? Or, you know, are you doing your work early to prepare for that next step? If your man has the ball or doesn't have the ball, you're on the weak side. Are you between ball and man? Are you in a help spot ready to rotate? Are you seeing both, or are you ball watching? Are you communicating with anyone else on your team? Are you over helping to where someone's driving and you're standing next to your teammate in a scenario where you don't have to do that? How much space is there between you and your defender once they start moving? Is a big, are you active? Are you with the level of the screen? Are you communicating to your guards what their coverage is going to be? Are you showing your hands on a post up? Are you ready to contest? Are you sliding your feet? What are your rotations like on the baseline? As a team, are you communicating? Are you ready to help each other? Do you communicate when you have to rotate? Are you anticipating the next play that's happening? Are you defending together on a string? So when you see one player move or rotate, are the other players also moving? Are you back to recover? Is there a breakdown? Are you covering for each other? So if it looks like a play is open, do you see the defense take it away and then recover to the next part and then recover to the next part? Some people call it the blender. Defensively, you have to scramble when you are in the blender. How clean are your switches? Mm-hmm. Are you ready to switch? Are you communicating this switch? Three phases of defense, Takai, as I always say. You're either dictating, anticipating, or reacting. And you have to live within all three of those phases. The best teams, obviously, they can dictate terms. They can take you out of your sets. They can disrupt your ball movement. They contain your drive. We're pushing catches out. We're fighting over screens. We're pressuring the ball. We're switching X, Y, and Z. You know?
The Thunder.
Yeah, you had to say that. I know that. And you're not wrong. Good defense, you got to anticipate. You know, you got to see what a team's trying to do defensively, what they're trying to run, what their offensive goal is, what they're trying to do. Do you see a stunt and recover? You know, do you show early help? Are you seeing what actions are coming or what a defense is trying to do? You know, if you watch Minnesota, like everyone likes to switch against Anthony Edwards and then show three or four people at him. That's anticipating. Like, we are anticipating that you're either about to drive and the people behind me have my back and the people behind them have their back. That's anticipating what a team may do. And then, you know, putting yourself in position to defend. And then if you're reacting, yeah, you're behind what the offense is doing. Screen, oh, I'm late. Oh, no. Oh, wait, that's the ball's there. We need to help. Oh, wait, it went to the three-point line. Oh, no.
Got to close out.
Those type of plays. So that's kind of my overall non-condensed spiel of things to look at defensively from the back of my brain.
There we go. And this is one of the many reasons why Steve is the always excellent Steve. You are all over my notes. I don't even know if I need to read mine. Just know that I'm looking at similar things, Ellie. So there you go. For the interest of time. It literally starts for me. Are you doing your homework early, getting into bodies before screens? I'm just like, okay, nah, Steve just hit literally everything. So I don't even need to. It is cool. It's cool.
There has to be one. Come on.
Nah, dog. Even getting to the teams. Like, how smoothly is everyone's job being done? Are you connected? Rotations happening at once? If it's a switch, does everyone know it's a switch? Like, no, you just kind of, you got it. It's almost like you've been doing this for, you know.
I cooked.
It's almost like you did this and also lived it and, you know, have NBA experience and things. It's kind of crazy what that comes with. How about that? Question two. Does it make sense for our beloved Brooklyn Nets to ditch MPJ by the deadline? He's playing very well, unfortunately. It could be an important piece on a contending team. Where would you like to see him go? Can I add the second part? But, Steve, do you have MPJ thoughts? Should he be traded? Is he being showcased to be traded? Or is he just a piece of whatever his next version of Brooklyn Nets basketball is going to be?
Well, you know, this is trade destination talk, so I am going to take the ball pump fake and throw it back to you to see how you feel on if MPJ should be traded or if the Nets should move forward.
Okay. I think the MPJ thing is an interesting one because I was, as you know, Steve, excited to watch this version of the Brooklyn Nets. And then like that opening week and a half happened and MPJ just did not want to defend. And I was like, hey, man, and he wasn't the only one. I want to be very clear and fair there. But I was like, hey, man, come on. It is worth noting, one, while it still isn't where I want it to be consistently, like the effort has gotten better. On the other end, he is just having a career year. Career high in points, 24.3, converting 59% of his twos on career high volume. 36% from three on career high volume, nearly 9 3-point attempts. He's getting to the line more than he ever has. 7 boards, 3 assists. And like watching him drive the basketball more, funny one for me, he's averaging 7.5 drives per 100 possessions, which still isn't a high number. But his previous career high was 4.2 3 years ago. He's driving more. And the kicker, Steve, on possessions featuring a Michael Porter Jr. drive, 1.21 points per possession on those trips. Among 120 players to log at least 75 drives as of recording, that is fifth in the NBA.
Oh, my.
Anthony Edwards, Luka Doncic, Austin Reeves, Julius Randle are the four players ahead. And that group of five is the only, those are the only players over 1.2. It's kind of absurd. And like offensively, again, we know what kind of shooter he is. The movement stuff, the cutting, the chemistry he's been able to build with Nick Claxton. I'll once again say Nick Claxton's been fun this year. Like that's kind of popping on film. So like it's very easy to see how he could fit into a better team or better roster context. Like he's not far removed from literally winning a championship with the Denver Nuggets. And so two teams that I thought about. It's like who could use, who would want the size, who could use more three-point shooting, and who could use more three-point volume.
Okay.
Two teams that came to mind. Naturally, the Thompsons are very well represented. I thought about Houston. I thought about Detroit.
Hmm. I'm intrigued and wondering how we got here.
Because I think with Houston, who they've been a very good offense. The three-point percentage has been high. The three-point volume has been very low. So just on a very basic level, do you want to add another 6'10 dude into this context where the defense is already really good? Your job is to knock down threes. And if KD or Alperen Sengun get double teamed, you cut. He can work in that context, I believe. And in terms of actually building out the seeds of a deal, the Rockets do have the salaries to do so. And if there is any kind of hesitation about paying Tari Eason this offseason, I would personally keep him. It's been an up and down season for him, but like I would personally invest. But if you do have those questions, he could be the young piece that the Brooklyn Nets would want. And then you do just have salary elsewhere. If it's Fred and he's moved elsewhere, if you get to Dorian Finney-Smith plus like Clint or so, like they have avenues to do that for MPJ if they want to. So like that was one. And then Detroit, like I've talked about Lauri Markkanen, I would love him there. I just wrote about like potentially Zach LaVine, just trying to add some shooting into the building to create more space for Cade Cunningham and Jalen Duren. MPJ is kind of like the midpoint of that, right? Where I would imagine he has a little bit more trade value than Zach LaVine because of the contract, age, et cetera. He's certainly not as good as Lauri Markkanen, so you're not going to have to do that. So it's just like, okay, does he fit into that? And like Detroit also has multiple salaries to get here. If you want to build a deal around like Jaden Ivey, who we're going to talk about in a little bit, like that could be the quote unquote young piece to build something around if you want, if you're Brooklyn. They did just make a bunch of swings in the guard room in the draft, so that would be an easy counter to that. But just theoretically, they could do it if they wanted to.
Ooh, we. Oh, I feel like Rockets and Pistons fans are going to jump you like TVS is on sale.
Probably. Again, those are just two teams off the top of my head. I don't see it. But like those two came to mind for me as far as like good teams that could use the shooting.
Understood. I think for me, if you're the Nets, if the right deal pops up, sure. But he kind of does a thing that this team needs very specifically in this roster context. You like to shoot, go shoot. You fit in with what we're doing to a degree. That's fine. Mm-hmm. So it's like, okay, we're trying to build something else. Have a blast, man.
Yeah.
And they've always kind of had that in-between player, in-between eras where it's like, yeah, go ahead.
Get your buckets. Well, that makes sense. And especially with like Cam Thomas being out. I think if Cam was healthy and this was still happening, it'd be easier to do the MPJ thing because you would still just have, here's the guy that's going to get us buckets in the half court post move. But like with him also out, it's just like, hey, if we are drafting Yegor and all these guards and things, like they do need someone that can take some pressure off of them. We cannot trade all of the scoring away and still have a context in which the players that we just invested in draft-wise can still thrive. So makes sense. It was not a thing that Brooklyn has to do. To your point, Steve, if a good enough deal comes up, then it makes sense. But I'm intrigued by those two teams. I'm trying to think, is there anybody else? Like, San Antonio, interesting. If we're talking about a team that has the salary, could use the shooting. Like San Antonio's another one that could get there if they wanted to. I'm trying to think. Anybody else that I want to shout out in this segment? Toronto could. They just have the salaries for everyone. Mentioned that already. How would you feel? No, I'm not going to get yelled at from our podcast pals in Ohio, so I'm going to leave that one alone. All right. We're going to take a break before I get lost in trade land. But when we return, we have more awesome mailbag questions coming your way. All right, and we are back, and it's time to go right back to the mailbag. This one coming from our dear pal, Crab, who says, since Steve posted last week that the Heat offense is a bit to exploit overhelping, the instances of three Bulls defenders coming to wall off L.A. Larson or whoever while leaving Khalil Ware undefended have jumped off the page. But it's also opened up two broader questions for me. Number one, how much do you two see defensive chemistry carry over from season to season? The Bulls roster is largely the same, so I think that they'd be better about trusting each other, even if the base talent level on defense isn't particularly high. Will overhelping level off as the season progresses?
Well, I think it's really hard to copy and paste defensive success from year to year. Mm-hmm. It's a dangerous thing to do. You have a base, but you still have to do it from year to year, if that makes sense. And so I think it ties into something that I felt the last 2-3 years, where because of the limited practice time, you know, limited shoot arounds, maybe not every team gets the same game plan, attention, detail. There's a balance of defenses saying, okay, let's worry about what we do versus let's try and take something away from them. You have the teams that have to rely on their base a little bit more, and their principles may not be the strongest, depending on who's in the lineup from first unit to second unit. And that's where you get some of the overhelping where, okay, that's a drive. We probably could have stayed home. Oh, but I saw a drive, so I know I need to help. You're losing some of the scheme nuance. Mm-hmm. And it's like, I'm doing what I think I'm supposed to do as opposed to having a feel for when to execute that. And I think as you see the season progress, you see the difference between the really, really good defensive teams. And you see the difference between some of the teams that are working on that end but aren't consistent. And so to the question at hand, defensive chemistry can carry over from season to season, especially if you have high defensive personnel. But I think you need to have the defensive personnel to be able to have that. Because if your guys are offensive minded, it's not necessarily in their bones to a degree, right? Mm-hmm. So if you're the grit and grind Grizzlies, you can probably eventually find the microwave and heat things up. But you still have to do it. Mm-hmm. If you're an offensive first team, like let's just take like the Kings, for example, the Beam era Kings, Sabonis Fox, yeah, that one. They had the offense, they had to work towards the defense, and that takes effort to get there. Mm-hmm. So it's like a different deal, and you have different personnel, you have different screen navigators, you have different bigs, you have different helpers. So okay, Giannis might look like a great helper in one scenario, and then he might be on a team where he's in action more, and now we don't have that. So just kind of it changes and flows based on your roster construction and how teams decide they want to attack you, because you can have the same defensive mindset you want, but teams have decided, hey, you know, like Houston's carried over I think pretty well year to year, but if teams are like, hey, reach up or come here, buddy, that presents a different challenge. Mm-hmm.
I like that. I think, one, just on a base level, I really appreciate this question because I don't think we, like, collectively, I don't think we talk enough about, like, defensive chemistry building. I think so much conversation as you add new players or trade for new players, draft new players, whatever, it's just like, okay, how do they fit into the offense? What is the usage going to be like? Who's getting what amount of touches? Yada, yada, yada. We very rarely talk about, we're adding another person to this defensive infrastructure. And like the nuances within that, like there's a very base level. This is a good defender. He should help. This is a bad defender. He needs help. But like what that actually means isn't discussed enough. So I like this question. I really like your answer there, Steve. And so like to bounce off of that, like I do think it takes some time to kind of learn your teammates defensively. Because like with the Chicago example in particular, like not much has changed. Like, it hasn't been a super overhaul in terms of their roster or in terms of their scheme. Like, they're still just going to send a whole bunch of stuff down the sideline, et cetera. But, like, they have kind of downsized the lineup a little bit, at least in, like, kind of the wing room. And then, like, now adding, like, an Isaac Okoro, like, you have to adjust, like, oh, this is a little bit better than what we're accustomed to. And some of the backline stuff's like, ooh, maybe this isn't as tight as we are accustomed to. And so, like, kind of learning how much help do I need to show within what our base is and stuff. Like, I think little things like that take some time. So I like that portion of it. I would imagine that the overhelping is going to level off, at least to a degree. But, like, your personnel is your personnel at the end of the day. Like, if you don't have high-level containers of the basketball, like, there's just going to be a general level of angst, I think. Just to give a general answer there. Like, I know the Bulls are very much like, we do not want to give up threes. We're going to contest at the rim if we need to. But, like, there is still just a general, like, if I know my guy can't really hold up, I'm probably going to, just, it's human nature. I'm going to want to cheat on him a little bit.
No, bring back tough twos. Stop getting cooked. Bring back tough twos.
I don't disagree.
Bring back tough twos and you getting cooked. Stop getting cooked.
I don't disagree at much lower stakes. This is just me on 2K these days where like the overhelping started to get me. I think this is your fault, Steve. Complimentary. Where I'm just like, I don't want to give up catch and shoot threes ever on 2K. Like, hey, man, if somebody gets hit on the cut, like they just got to do better about that. Or if someone's getting baked with these pull-up jumpers, like you just got to press triangle. You know what I mean? That's a whole nother podcast to do. That is A-okay. To the second question, a Miami Heat theme question. How do you two expect to see Miami's offense evolve over the season as teams adjust to them? Besides tapping the Warriors Twitter trademark run more pick and rolls button, what other layers can Spo mix into this offense, assuming no major trades or injuries? Is it more off-ball screens for shooters a la Duncan Robinson? And more broadly, to what extent can a coach plan to build out an offense over the course of a season?
Well, I mean, I think you'll see more pick and roll. I think it'll just be the timing of when they go to it. I think you'll see more pin down staggers for Norman Powell, Tyler Hero. You'll see those mixed in. I think you'll see more for Bam Adebayo as things roll on. So I think there'll be a stronger mix, especially in the half court. In those moments where you can't flow as much. To an extent, a coach can plan to build out an offense over the course of the season. It's tricky. I mean, sometimes you're still putting things in. Sometimes you find things that work, and so you enhance it. Sometimes you're running different sets all the way through. You just kind of pick and choose and find different things throughout the course of the season. Like I've seen where, you play a team, and okay, I like this play. Let's do this part of it and add this to it. And now, okay, we have a set. Or you run an ATO and it works, and it's like, ooh, what else can we get out of this? Mm-hmm. And so it's more your principles or your ideals are the same. How much of the half-court sets are in, that can develop over time, depending on what how defenses are treating you, how you're trying to counter certain, coverages, or if you're trying to get certain looks for different people, that can vary in flow, but you are who you are, and your core sets are usually put in pretty early. And you're just kind of adding throughout the season.
Okay, I like it. I think to bounce off of the first part of your answer, like I do think there is just more varied usage available for Bam Adebayo. I think that's probably the lowest hanging fruit to how can this offense evolve or how can they do different things. So it's not just drive, kick, clear cut was, clear space with a cut, drive, kick again, et cetera. Last year, Steve, Bam was running about 16 dribble handoffs a game towards the top of the league. Do you know what that is this year? Or 16 per 100 possessions, I should clarify. Do you know what his number is this year?
Four.
Half of that.
Two.
Yeah. Well, 1.9, but like, yes. Oh. I think there's in a literal sense, there's quite a bit of space between like 16 per 100 and 2 per 100. I think if you're looking for low-hanging fruit in the half court, some of the Bam is based on the wing can be replaced with kick the ball to Bam. He gets to make handoff decisions. And you kind of generate some juice there. And then that just naturally turns into two-man action. So that's not going to turn Miami from 30th in pick-and-roll volume or handoff volume to like 8th. They're not going to do that. I do think they want to maintain this foundation of we are going to win these drives. We're going to space in a certain way. Y'all going to have to deal with us. But there's low-hanging fruit within their spacing alignment to where they can generate more two-man actions without deviating too far. So I would expect to see more of that, especially with Tyler Hero back in the fold. So I think I start there. And even to your off-ball screening portion, like Norm gets those pin downs or gets those staggers. Tyler's certainly going to get that. I want to say Miami was in the top 10 in off-ball screen usage last year, and they are 26th this year. Like, again, there's a wide spectrum between those two numbers. Like, I would imagine you can sprinkle in more of that stuff, even if it's just a jump start too. We're now getting into driving kickoff of this, and we're respacing, we're cutting, we're doing all the things. So I would imagine we're going to see more of that as the season goes along. Yeah, I think that's where I land on that, honestly. But the Miami offense is just a fascinating concept to me. I talked about how enjoyable it is earlier in the week, but like,
yeah, and you should go and you will listen to the last our earlier episode this week for more thoughts on the Miami Heat offense. What's the next question?
All right, well then we go to Nico, who says, "Hi, Steven Jones, incredible callback, by the way. But first, a formal congrats on the first Yahoo mailbag. It's been fulfilling to track where you two started and where are now. So thank you for that. My question is, what should teams, and I suppose we, expect for the replacement players of core pieces who got injured? For context, so far this season, we've seen Denver lose Christian Brown and Aaron Gordon. The Spurs lose Wemby, Dylan Harper, and Stephon Castle. And the Lakers lose LeBron to start the season and now DeAndre Ayton. Despite this, all three teams have managed so far to stay afloat despite losing key pieces to their identity as a team, as Denver has used Tim Hardaway Jr., Peyton Watson, and Spencer Jones. The Spurs have used Luke Kornet for Wemby, and Kelly Olynyk is kind of their backup point guard or backup initiator. And the Lakers have used Jake LaRavia, Marcus Smart, and Rui Hachimura to help replace LeBron while he was out. Should we expect teams to shift their identity to fit in those guys? Ask them to approximate what they lost as it is a chance for growth and development. An example would be giving Peyton Watson the on-ball rails of Aaron Gordon, or to just fulfill what their roles were, but on a higher scale.
I mean, probably the latter, fulfill what their roles were, but on a higher scale. I think the thing with the examples you used and some of the tie-ins, the team's identity allows these players to fit into what the team needs or what the team wants to do. If you look at Oklahoma City, hasn't mattered who's been in the uniform, because if you're in the game, you know exactly what you're supposed to do. You're empowered. You know your role. Detroit, they had almost everyone go down in the middle of this winning streak. Mm-hmm. We know we have an opportunity to play. We know we have to defend. We fit into what, that's what we do as a team. So you find yourself in these scenarios where if you have a strong identity as a team, you can put people in and plug and play a little bit. And so, yeah, Peyton Watson will be more involved. That's a good thing. You don't want to give him all of the Aaron Gordon thing because you don't want to change his overall role, which is, hey, defense, get after it. Mm-hmm. Get after it on defense and let the offense find you. Let the offense come to you. You don't want to shift that too much. But you have more of an opportunity and you're more empowered. So there are more opportunities for you to play. The team's identity, and that's why it's important to have that, dictates so much of how you are able to elevate and go to next man up. If you don't have that, you see these teams that struggle once injuries hit because, okay, more players are playing, but what are you bringing to the table? How are you helping our team? I think the San Antonio one probably speaks stronger to the identity they're building to have success without Wemby than anything else.
Yeah, I like that. Like, I think it's team specific for me. And I think it ties into your point about like who has identities established and who doesn't. Because I think for teams that don't have that identity, there feels like there's more room for, okay, this new guy has to step up. He has a little bit more room to explore, and that can go either way. Like, you can get the random, oh, he's much better than I thought he was. Now we have some decisions to make. Or we don't know what we're doing. We don't know what we're getting. There's just a level of haze now. You more so feel that offensively than defensively, but it all kind of bleeds in together. And so I think to answer your question, like on a basic level, like I think I agree with Steve. It is going to be more of the latter. Like Peyton Watts or Spencer Jones, I do not need you to be Christian Brown. We need you to defend and knock down open shots when you have them. I don't need you to be one of the best transition scorers in the league, though that would also obviously be a bonus. If you can approximate that kind of value in the short term, like, heck yeah, we're going to take that. But we just need you to be you. Like, the Peyton Watson of it all is interesting. Like, no, we don't need you to be Aaron Gordon, but we kind of wanted you to be an upside piece for us anyway. So, like, if you can block shots and then also do the defense thing, and, like, these drives hit and you hit threes, it's like, oh, wait a minute. That's going to be interesting, which then leads into, like, future contract decisions, all that good stuff. So, like, I think it can also vary by player, but I do think it's more so of the latter. So I'll give Steve the hat tip on that one.
Perfect.
There we go. And we now move to our next question. This one's going to come from Deshae. You have permission to yell at me if I mispronounce that. I want to get names right for very obvious reasons. It's the right thing to do, but also I know what I've dealt with. So feel free to yell. But two Pistons questions. And to give a little bit of context, this was sent in earlier in November. This was before the Jaden Ivey debut, just to add that context. But biggest Pistons fan in the state of New Jersey here with two questions. Number one, when I watch my Pistons play basketball, it seems the Cade Jalen Duren pick and roll is completely unstoppable. My question to you all is, why is it so unstoppable? What is the effective defensive strategy to prevent it? What are these players doing that makes it so effective? Is it physical tools, chemistry, the size, all the above? Why does it look so easy for Cade and Duren to pull these lobs off against some of the best games and players in the world?
Well, I mean, I think it's the chemistry they have. It's the growth of Cade Cunningham as a scorer and a playmaker. It's the growth of Jalen Duren as a finisher, as a decision maker on the short roll. All of that together puts pressure on defenses to what level of comfort do we have with this scheme? If we put two on the ball and, you know, we're at the level of the screen, we trap Cade, that's going to open up the role for Jalen Duren. Mm-hmm. He catches it. It's not like he has to just get a lob. He catches it in the middle of the paint, and you're small, he's going to hit you. You're big, he's going to hit you. Or if there's people early, he'll kick it and they'll play out of it. They make enough shots there. Cade in a drop, he's able to navigate the space. You don't know if he's going to get to a pull-up, get to a step back, get to a drive, finish, or a late lob for Duren. And so you find yourself in these scenarios where, okay, they're able to poke at those coverages and make you a little bit uncomfortable. And so I think that's been it. If you take one of those two pieces away, you probably feel comfortable. You can pick and choose a little bit more. Mm-hmm. Okay, Cade's doing this, or Jalen Duren, you got to make a play. But they've been able to consistently beat teams, so that's, to me, is the strength of those two.
Okay. No, I'm right there with you, Steve. Like, I think when you have tall playmaker that can make just about every pass in the book and comfortable inside the arc score, you combine that with bone crushing screen setter that also has juice inside the arc as a finisher, self creator, and playmaker, as you've talked about and written about. Yeah, it just feels like they have the theoretical answers to all of the tests. It is still up to them to execute, which is where, like, I looked up, because it has felt very good this season. We both talked about the Pistons and what those two have done in particular. And so I look up, you know, the pick and roll efficiency. They were, I want to say last year, they were like the highest volume pick and roll pairing in the league. And so that is once again carried over as of recording, 259 on-ball picks between those two. But it's a shade under 0.9 points per possession on those pick and roll trips, which is 29th of 35 duels to run at least 100 as of recording. And like, that surprised me, because you look at how good Cade is, how good Jalen Duren is. I think that is more of a product of Cade makes the right pass, Jalen Duren makes the right pass, and like 3-point shots are being missed more than like those two aren't doing good things. And so like, that would probably be my primary reason for why that number is lower than you would expect. But to the general question, Cade's incredibly good, incredibly crafty. Jalen Duren can pry guys open. He can make reason open space. And so when they are humming to that degree, there really isn't a great answer. Like, the easiest answer is probably going to be to switch and then show help off of one of Detroit's non-shooters just to cramp space for them, which again goes to more of their context than them and kind of limiting efficiency that way. But no, those two guys just have a level of chemistry and their skill sets match in a way that makes it difficult for defense to deal with 2-on-2. And as for the second Pistons question, I'm a big fan of Jaden Ivey, but it's getting harder and harder to ignore the fact that our team just seems to really hum despite his absence. And again, context, this email was sent in on November 5th. This was before the Ivey debut. And the start of the season seems to have solidified that our true core should be built around Cade Cunningham, Asar Thompson, Jalen Duren, plus shooting threats.
No, defense. Keep going.
I love that. I've been hearing the Lauri Markkanen trade rumor since last year, but what are your thoughts about a straight-up Kobe White, Jaden Ivey swap? It seems like Chicago is fully entrenched in five-out lineups with significant rim pressure. That's where Jaden Ivey would fit in. And the Pistons need a guard next to Cade that is both a reliable shooting threat and can handle ball handling responsibilities as needed, where Kobe White comes in. Who says no?
I mean, if I'm Detroit, I say no. Not that Kobe White isn't talented, but we got a good thing going here. And we just got Jaden Ivey back. And he's coming back to a scenario where, hey, bud, you see, we got a good thing going here. Let's go. Welcome back. So let's see what that looks like first before we go swinging for the fences.
Mm-hmm. And I will say, since Jaden Ives come back, and again, just talked about this earlier in the week, very small samples, what, 2-3 games, but like shooting 50% from three on moderate volume. And like he was a good catch and shoot 3-point shooter last year. And so to the shooting portion, obviously there's a volume threshold you want to hit, which kind of blends into how our defense is treating you. So like you want to see that continue to rise. But I think the potential is there for Jaden Ivey to produce rim pressure and to knock down shots off of Kate. We've already seen seeds of what that can look like. I think for Jaden, aside from the obvious please stay healthy, it is going to be his growth as a finisher. That's going to be the biggest thing offensively at this point. What does the in-between game look like? And when you are actually amongst the trees, because the athleticism pops, but like that efficiency just has not translated yet. He's still trying to navigate how to deal with those kind of contests at the rim. If that pops, I don't think you have those questions. As far as the who says no of it all, this feels like more of a question to, like, I think Ivy's extension eligible, or was. Kobe White is just a free agent this summer. Ivy, obviously younger, but it's just like, as we get into locking in salaries with this Detroit core, to your point, how much is Ivy going to garner versus how much is White going to garner? Because I do think, like, on balance, Kobe White is a better basketball player right now. It's just like, can you split the difference some kind of way there? I feel like Detroit says no before Chicago does. So I agree with Steve on that point. Like, I am kind of intrigued by, like, what a swap there would look like. It's not like Kobe's been super available this year either. Like, he isn't too far off from making his season debut. But
hey, you can't forget the human element as well. You cannot forget the human element of it as well. I think Detroit, keep this going, see exactly how far this goes, and then see whatever moves you got to make. You know, I think there was a quote from Cade a few days ago. It's like, it would mean a lot for him and Jaden to show what they can finally do together, because their relationship off the court. So, yeah, let's let that rock.
Let it cool. Okay. I respect it. All right. Next one going to come from Miles. This is a question being asked a little bit earlier in November as well. Nikias and Steve, this is more directed towards Nikias, mostly because this will wind him up. But what is Trendon Watford's ceiling? What is his ideal world? Who, besides Philly, needs his skill set the most? My years of T-Watt lust are being vindicated by his recent performance, and I am at the top of the world. Sincerely yours, Trendon Watford Truther. I tell you what, this has been a fun season for Trendon Watford. Like, the kind of tweener four that can put the ball on the floor and can make passes you didn't think that he could make, like, those players naturally appeal to me. So, like, he's absolutely right that this question would get me wound up. I like him in Philly, honestly. Like, just giving some sort of outlet to, like, Tyrese in space and, like, let you make some decisions as Tyrese Maxey continues to average over 40 minutes and do virtually everything for the Sixers offense as they try to get healthy around him. But I like him in any place that could use kind of like a second wave in the half court, and or has a guard that can consistently draw two. So the Trendon Watford drives and the playmaking off of those drives can really pop. And so, like, funny enough, like, him plus Cade would probably be fun. Like, I don't think Detroit would do that. But, like, that would be kind of fun if there was front court room for him. If not there, so I was trying to think through some teams that would make some sense for him. It's one of those, if Trey was healthy, he'd be fun in Atlanta in that four room. I think he could pop there. The Lakers would be a fun spot. I guess the Lakers appeal to me just because Luka's going to draw two. And, like, obviously the collective passing ability of him and LeBron. But it's just, like, because they're so like-sized, would those be switches? But also, who's defending Trendon Watford? Do you really want to switch that defender onto a Luka or LeBron? So, like, the Lakers would be fun. I think he'd pop in that context as well. Denver would be fun. There aren't many places where he couldn't carve out a role if this is just who he is offensively. Like, I'm not going to hold you. Steve, do you have any Trendon Watford thoughts?
No. To the next question from Don Might it be time for the NBA to eliminate the conferences entirely and realign to 5-6-team divisions? Specifically, if Portland returned to the Pacific and Washington to the Atlantic and Minnesota moved to the Central Division, the remaining 12 teams split neatly into Southeast, Atlanta, Charlotte, Memphis, Miami, New Orleans, Orlando, and Southwest, Dallas, Denver, Houston, OKC, San Antonio, Utah divisions. And scheduling would seem to be simple enough. Home and away against every other team, 58 games. An additional home and away versus each divisional rival, 10 games. Plus additional home and away games against two other divisions in rotation. Six of each making 12 games total for a grand total of 80 regular season games. Playoff, 16 teams with the division winners initially seeded 1-5, but reseeding by best record after every round. This would seem to be an improvement upon the current setup, in that it would increase divisional compactness, make for better balanced playoffs, and put an end to jokes about the Leastern Conference once and for all. Thank you for your time. Nikias, do you have thoughts?
I ain't gonna hold you, Steve. I kind of like it. Like, I don't think it would happen. Because it's 80 games and not 82. And it's like, for any difference there, isn't that what the NBA Cup is for? So, like, I guess there are some scheduling things that could have to be worked out there, because I don't know if the league wants to give up two games of gate revenue and all that good stuff. But like, I'm kind of intrigued. Like, I guess I'll toss this question to you. Like, is there a way to make divisions matter? And do you care if divisions matter in this stage of NBA basketball?
What do you mean by divisions matter?
I mean, like, just... I don't know. Like, it just doesn't feel like people have juice for, like, NBA divisional matchups like you do with, like, AFC East matchups, et cetera. Like, obviously, there's just a difference in games and thus difference in stakes between the
NBA. Oh, yeah, and man. NFL. Yeah, so, sign like, me up for sign me up for Dolphins Jets, buddy.
Well, no, but like you get the general point that I'm making there. I'm just like, they do even now. Like, they just play each other more than they play any other opponent. It just feels like outside of you get Lakers Clippers because they are just literally in the same spot. There's naturally building stuff there. It doesn't feel like there's a ton of those. To where those division matchups really pop to that degree. So I'm just like,
there's a lot of player movement.
Yeah.
So it just feels has a little bit of a different feel. I mean, and there's a ring culture. So, you know, what seed did you get is more important. They don't even respect conference finals runs, let alone division winning. Winning's hard. People don't respect it. And so it's fine. Also, please respect my NBA Cup. Where does that factor into the schedule? The Eastern Conference is fun. Please respect my conferences, Western Conference and Eastern Conference. Please give me my tradition. I'm 38 years old. Stop changing stuff.
You know what? I feel you.
No disrespect, Don. Great question. Thank you for it, but please.
I do think it's a pretty solid proposal. It could have been thought put into this. Like, I don't mind it.
So, fantastic.
All right. Well, final one that we have. This one coming from Brandon. Hey, guys, love the work you do. This is an all-star game fix. This is what Brandon proposes.
Oh, my.
Come on. All right. So the all-star game remains East versus West. But the winner clinches home court advantage in the finals. So whoever comes out of whatever conference will get home court advantage. The top six seeds on the winning conference team clinches at least a play-in spot, raising the importance of the season up to that point in time. In the rare event that any of those six clinching seeds drops to the 11 to 15 seed in their actual standings, the final seeding is determined by a regular season tiebreaker. Also, each team that has an all-star representative for the winning conference team will get a $100,000 bonus per player.
I once again say, please respect the NBA Cup. you want a bonus? Win these games, buddy. Here's the thing. I don't know if I want home court advantage clinched because Stephen Curry made 8 threes in the first 4 minutes of an all-star game. And now... the 7-seed Portland Trailblazers have made a run to the finals and are granted home court advantage. I don't know how I feel about that. I don't. Look, man, the All-Star game is going to come back at some point. But here's the problem, man. Everyone likes to shoot threes. No one wants to drive. One team hits 98 threes and it's a 30-point game. Like, I don't know what to tell you. That's just the bit. It's been that every year. I know everyone's like, oh, the compete level. No. It's usually pretty okay for a little bit, and then someone makes a bunch of threes, and it's a 20-point game. I'm sorry.
But see, that's
love the effort.
But that's where the competitive pride comes in, Steve. You're down 20. Let's get this thing down to 12. Let's get it down to 8. If you can get it down to 8, anything can happen. You know, that's what the people needs, what the people want, Steve. But no. There's been so much conversation about, like, should the All-Star game determine home court event? Like, I can't really get there. Like, I don't think it's an egregious concept. Like, we've seen it elsewhere. But, like, I can't personally get there. Especially to your point, we've had in recent years, like, the Heat making a finals run from the play-in. And, honestly, it's probably easier to pull now just because, I mean, the Thunder are just who they are type beat. But that always gets a little hazy. The thing that had me in a headlock was the seeds clinching, like, at least a play-in spot and, like, trying to make the regular season matter. Like, I ultimately don't think this would be agreed to, but, like, the concept of making the record, quote-unquote, matter more through February, I am intrigued to hear more proposals of, like, how you could make that happen. Like, I just like the thought exercise, not necessarily I'm clamoring for league-wide change. But, like, I just had never considered that kind of concept. Like, I ultimately say no, that's probably too far, especially since injuries can hit, teams can drop, et cetera, et cetera. But, like, the actual concept itself, like, I'm interested in hearing more ideas at the very least. So I do want to give the quick hat tip there.
Have you seen the Western Conference? You know its existence? Have you seen the standings? You literally have a bad 2 days.
Yeah.
Or you have three days of rest and you are in the play-in.
Yeah.
Okay.
Hey, big dog, you better win these games. You know what I mean? When we get in here, But that could get hazy. And then you factor in, like, some draft stuff. Like, that could get very funny with those kind of things. But, okay. Interesting enough idea. Steve, can I pose you a quick question?
Sure.
I saw a tweet. It got the brain churning for me. Okay. This one coming from Ben Pfeiffer. I think this was coming after or while watching the Lakers-Clippers game, which, boy, that was a high-scoring affair.
Okay, Ben.
But from Ben, really good draft/prospect work. You got to talk to him at some point. But Luka, LeBron, and Reeves are a GOAT-level passing trio. How many teams can even come close?
I have a question. Okay. I didn't mean to cut you off. Very good. Can we remove the GOAT portion for right now? Because I think that opens the door very wide. And I'm not trying to live a life where I offend Magic Johnson or Larry Bird or Oscar Robertson or any legend. Okay. Like, I'm not trying to get jumped by old Celtics or Lakers fans. And then is this based, like, if it was GOAT, is it based on when they played together? Is it overall? Like, where would, like, KD, Westbrook, Harden be?
I don't know if they – I don't think that gets super close. Like
– Okay. Well, I got another one for you behind door number 2.
Okay.
How about Tim Duncan, Tony Parker, and Manu Ginobili?
I can't get there. Not compared to these three.
You don't like the beautiful game?
I do. But there was certainly a collect the ball movement, you know, between those Spurs teams, especially on the high end. So, like, they deserve their respect. But it's just, like, I don't think either of Duncan, Manu, or Tony Parker were as good of passers as Luka, much less you factor in Luka plus LeBron plus...
So is this literal passing ability or is this based on attention defenses give to parts of the trio? Because look, we can be very honest about this trio.
Go ahead.
It's the dragon meme.
Like I think it's very much Luka LeBron duo. Austin Reeves is a good passer/playmaker, but like he is not like Luka and LeBron are conservatively two of the top like 12 passers of all time. So like there is a very big drop off there. So like the duo is carrying a lot of the work. That is fair to acknowledge, while also acknowledging Austin Reeves is good in his own right. But, like, he's not those two. But, like, that duo is so freaking good. It's hard for me to get there. Like, my first thought as I was trying to think through this was, like, was there a Celtics team? Because you obviously have Bird, who is a super high-level passer. But, like, you know, through that era, like, you had some Dennis Johnson. You had some, like, there was the one, like, Bill Walton bench. Like, you had some guys that overlapped. And I was like, I don't know if I can get there compared to, like, this trio. Or if we want to isolate this duo of Luka and LeBron. Like, how often have we had, like, two of the best passers, forget history for a moment. It just... a team has two of the 10 best passers in the league on the same team. Like, how often has that happened?
Not very. This is why this is, I'm not going to say more words, but we understand. No, that's not how it's supposed to work. You're not supposed to be able to do that. That's not, no. I mean, would you put the James Harden, Chris Paul duo anywhere near that stratosphere? I don't know, man.
Like, I would put, yeah. Like, I thought about those Houston teams. So, like, I think that's a conversation. And even then, it's just like, okay, who's the third?
Okay. Ooh, can I make everyone mad real quick?
Sure.
What about Bron, Kyrie, and Kevin Love?
No.
You don't respect full court outlet passes?
I do. Dragon meme. But. But then I was like, okay, is there like a Bron Wade team that I could get to? But even then, it's just like, who's the third in that case? And like, as much as I love Dwayne Wade for very obvious reasons, as you can, I mean, but like, I don't think Dwayne Wade was a Luka level passer. I don't think that's disrespectful to say. So like, even then, it's just like, I don't know, man. Like, going back, some of the Jerry West teams, question mark. Can we get there? Any of the super early Boston teams, can we get there? Like, probably not.
Are you invoking Bob Cousy? What's going on here?
That would have to be a very specific relative to league talent at the time. But like, even then, it's like no.
All
right. like Bron and Luke, like, that's insane, man.
Yes. It's insane. Yes.
So like,
this is correct.
So I guess to like, who tops those three as a passing trio? Like, the answer is probably nobody. Who comes close? Like, I do like the Houston shout. Again, I'd like to think a little bit more about like, who the third player would be to complete the trio. But like, Paul plus Harden. Like, if it was... The thing that really messes me up about the OKC example with KD, Harden, and Russ is like, Harden and Russ weren't the passers they became when they were together yet.
That's why I asked, though. Is it based on what they were or who they are?
Yeah, I think based on who they are or who they were, I guess, in this case. So that's where I'm just like, I can't get there. If you were telling me like peak Harden plus peak Russ plus whichever you think is the best passing season of KD, like, it's probably still, I'm like, I think it's still just no. But like, I think that certainly gets you closer to all three of these guys are like on rookie scale contracts or close. Like, they just were not there yet. So we ain't got no other.
It's gonna be Wilt Chamberlain, Jerry West, and Elgin Baylor. It's fine.
Like, and I thought about Wilt too. I'm just like, I don't, because he could pass, but like, he was also like selfish passer dude. Like, it's a whole bit. All right, well, thank you, Ben, for the thought exercise that had me in a headlock. And thank you to everyone that sent in mailbag questions. Once again, if you ever have a random basketball thought or question while watching games, doing chores, at the job, leaving the job, whatever the case may be, email us at dunkerspot@yahoo.com. That is dunkerspot@yahoo.com. And we will get to those questions. So quick salute to y'all. And with that, we're going to take a little break. But when we return, we had a fun conversation with Gary Payton II. Can't wait for you to tap in. All right, joining us for part two of the podcast, current Golden State Warrior, 10-year NBA vet, Gary Payton II. Gary, welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm good. That sounds crazy that you said it out loud. 10 years is crazy. That's wild. That's crazy. But I'm doing good, fellas. How y'all doing?
Doing all right. Happy to have you here. Excited to talk some hoops and other things with you. So I guess just to start, you are fresh off of career high 8 assists, 9 points, 8 dimes, 6 boards in a win. But I wanted to ask, what is your first basketball memory?
It's tough. I couldn't tell you the first one, but I know it's in Seattle somewhere, running around Key Arena, you know, just messing around, going to practices with my dad, going to the game early, messing around with the opposing team's players, pregame, whatnot. So a lot of that has to do with Seattle and just, you know, being in the city and being around, you know, Sonics, Supersonics, and doing things with him within that. So, you know, a lot of good memories when I was young in Seattle.
That makes sense. I guess with basketball being that heavy of a background for you, were there any other sports that kind of captured your attention early on, or was it just basketball for you?
No, football. I liked football a lot. Dabbled with baseball a little bit and soccer, but just going through the process, you know, my dad being who he was, and just growing up with that shadow, I actually wanted to get away from the game just to kill the comparisons and whatnot, and, you know, just carve out my own identity and journey. I actually played water polo in Seattle for a season, so that was different, but I turned out to like water polo. Is a very physical sport, but it was different.
Well, I gotta ask, what was your favorite part about water polo? Because that looks incredibly difficult.
No, it was. I had to learn how to tread water. So once I learned how to tread water and move with the tread, and it got pretty fun. You know, you can like I said, it's pretty physical. So, you know, you can pull, you can stretch, you can pull them under the water and try to get to what you got to do. So I like the physical part of that. That was the part of the best fun part.
I would have imagined football, just with the way that you defend and the way you're able to halt things in the passing lanes. Like it just gives like corner or safety for me. Water polo.
Absolutely. Corner or safety. You know, they had me at outside linebacker sometimes when I was young. This was when I was young. And I was kind of taller and bigger than everybody, but for sure, corner and safety, and then on the offensive side, running back and wide receiver for sure.
That tracks. I would not have had water polo on the bingo card, but that is
awesome. That one's a little doozy. You know, I don't even know how that happened, to be honest. I think my mom was just like, let's try something new, and you know, she came. I don't know how she came up with water polo, but that was the first time that I was introduced to water polo, which was different.
Got you. I was reading a profile on you from a few years ago. I think Mark Spears did it. He was talking about some of the contracts that you apparently had to sign, promising that you would finish out a year of sports if you committed to it.
From my mom?
Yeah.
Yeah, probably right. I don't remember signing anything, but I'm sure that's what she had that in place for sure. That for all of us, you know, if we decided to do something, because I'm sure we was jumping around quite a few, you know. So I'm sure that's true for sure. That we had to finish out a sport that we committed to for sure.
I was like, ooh, that's a new one to kind of make sure that commitment is there. But okay.
No, absolutely. She knew what she was doing.
To the Warriors of it all, very quickly. It is a unique style of play on both ends for Golden State, at least during that era since you've been there. How much time did it take for you to kind of acclimate to how they want to do things on both ends of the floor?
I'd say my first 10 days. It was pretty simple. I had already had an idea once, you know, I got the call from the Warriors. I was already thinking basketball before I was with the Warriors, just like watching them. It's really simple if you think about it and you understand the game. You know, at the time we had the two best shooters, you know, possibly might be the two best shooters that the game's ever seen. And, you know, my style of play was being a defender. It was easy. Get a stop, get one of them the ball. You know, get them open so they can get a good look. And it was just like, there's nothing really much to it, you know, and having Draymond in that spot to facilitate and use those guys, you know, coming off screens, and you know how much attention they demand is easy. You know, I learned how to set screens when I was, JUCO in high school. You know, I had to play big, so I had to learn how to set screens and play the dunker spot, you know, early. So once I got with the best, it was easy. Set a screen for them. They two people go, slip, Draymond can, you know, facilitate and hit. And, you know, from there, it was just like we were winning games. So I was like, oh, this is easy. This is the formula.
Oh, see, that takes my question off the table for me, because I really wanted to get into the screening of it all with you. because I think we are seeing more inverted actions across the league over the past few years, really. Mm-hmm. And so what has always stood out to me with you in particular is not just you being used as a screener for Steph or for Clay. The fact that you actually hit people before getting out of there, it seems pretty rare for actual guards to want to get in to have that dirty work. So I wanted to know where that background came from, but you already mentioned kind of the JUCO.
That's the fun part, you know, the physicality and actually get to go and hit somebody. You know, the game is getting softer by the year, and they don't allow you to, you know, make that contact and have that a lot of contact. So, you know, just growing up, you know, fighting with my brothers, fighting with my cousins, you know, football, like I said, soccer is just the physicality of it, is what I like. And even though if you hit somebody and you set a good screen on somebody, you most likely going to get yourself open. So that's how I had to learn, and that's how I had to get my offense going, you know, when I was younger. So me learning early, you know, to actually hit somebody to open up, you know, for your teammate or and essentially for yourself, that was my way to stay on the court. So, you know, I just added that to my game.
I do have a question, because not only is the screening there, but also you mix in the slips. How long did it take you to kind of just know the difference or when, or did you just base it off how the defense was covering?
It's definitely Wardell. Okay. You gotta stay attached to Wardell. So if I can clip Wardell's guy just a little bit, my guy is going to naturally assume that his guy's behind and Steph's open, and we all know what happens if you think Steph's open. So they both jump out, and I'm 95% of the time I'm going to be by myself naked on the slip. So, you know, he creates 30 points for himself. He creates 30 for others. So the more times I can get with him and get into actions is, you know, more opportunities for him and also more opportunities for me.
Just to quickly bounce off of that, because there was like a two-play sequence I wanted to ask you about from the Utah game. It was early in that first quarter.
I think I know what you're talking about. Early in the quarter or late? The one, which one? Where you hit me and we hand back and he came back off the screen?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. That's just a little counter to, you know, if I set the first one and I hit the pocket and I go downhill, you know, and they seem to, you know, we dug that a couple times. We'll just throw a little hitch in there to get him an extra look and, you know, hit me and come right back off the screen. I'll just drop it off and hit his guy one more time. And, you know, other than that, they'll probably jump or, you know, they're behind. So they automatically going, you know, seem the worst and he's pulling up. So it's just another little glitch to get him an extra shot.
Yeah, they look defeated after that one. It's like, what are we supposed to do? We talk.
Yeah, you just can't relax with him. Once he gets the ball off, I think he's more dangerous without the ball than he is with the ball. Just because his conditioning and his pace, and he reads the game in the floor, like, you got to chase him. And if you get behind, like, somebody else is going to got to help you. And that's just him pulling the gravity of the court into the game. And, you know, he opens up a lot more for everybody else.
Got you. That's just to zoom out a little bit. Oh, Steve, do you have something?
No, you're good.
Oh, okay. That's just to zoom out a little bit. You seem surprised when I mentioned you're a 10-year vet now in the NBA. I wanted to ask, there are a lot of young guards and wings in that Warriors room now. Are you taking anyone under your wing?
It's just collectively, you know, all the young guys try to add, you know, that dunker spot. I'm trying to get Will, BP, and those young guys to understand the importance of, you know, being able to play the dunker, you know, just to be able to add another piece to the game, you know, that you can have, that you can stay on the floor, and that, you know, the coaching staff trusts you being in that spot and, you know, just making the right plays, reading the play and playing behind the defense. I play behind the defense is where I get a lot of my open looks, open layups. And I try to tell them that, you know, it's way easier, it's way convenient for yourself to play behind a dunker and get behind the defense and, you know, move around and be an outlet for those drivers and those playmakers like Steph and Jimmy. It's just another outlet, another, you know, safety net for us to have.
Gotcha. Well, I'd add real quick, how important is it, because the league has changed over time, how important is it for vets to be in those locker rooms and be able to pass down some of their wisdom and knowledge to the younger guards?
It's huge, you know. Like I said, you guys know there's guys that's been in the league for a while, and you know, towards the end of their career, they're still there. And guys be wondering why they're still there. Is because of that reason in the locker room, to teach them, to guide them, and you know, just to walk through. And it's so useful to have them in practice, you know, on trips, and to just to give to the next generation that's coming up and know that they're going to be taking over the league soon, just to, you know, show them tricks and trades of the league. And also the young guys is, you know, showing some of the vets, you know, the new tricks and trade, because it is getting younger and younger. So it goes both ways. But once the young guys figure it out, you know, they add their little twist to it. But the vets are a staple, you know, and pillars for organizations like that to, you know, be able to come in and have championship, you know, pedigree and championship mindset, and knows what it does and knows what it takes to win.
Got you. I think just to shift to the defensive side of the ball very quickly, you have made your name as a high level defender in this league, out of how you earned your place in. It's interesting hearing some of the conversations around NBA defense. I don't think people really understand how hard it is to guard in this era of NBA basketball. I guess for you, what are some misconceptions or maybe things that you may hear from the outside that you wish people understood? Like, no, we are trying to do X, Y, Z. It's just really tough right now.
No, it is. And that goes back to the game is changing. You know, the league is starting to be less handsy, you know, from coming from the 90s, which I wish I would have played in the 90s, and it would have been on and cracking and fun every night going up, you know, battling, fighting in there and just scrapping. But the league has changed, you know, for many reasons, and it's hard. It's just like being a corner. You got to mirror somebody, you know, all up and down the court. Okay, you can't touch them, so it's just like you're already at a disadvantage. So you know you gotta find ways, and you gotta play team defense. You gotta have an extra guy helping, just because of how the league is changing. He's handsy. There's a lot of guys getting calls now. A lot of offensive guys, you know, it's how to manipulate the game and the refs, how to get calls and whatnot. So you know, as a defender, you know, it's every year we're adjusting, you know, to the new calls, to the new style of play, to what the refs are in the league is emphasizing on the offensive side. So, you know, the biggest thing I can say is it's like being a corner. Just imagine if you're a corner and you had to, you know, guard Megatron or something, and you can't put your hands on him. So what you think gonna happen most of the time? He gonna win most of those battles for sure. Okay. So, you know, there's nothing really to argue about or whatever. It's just like, bro, we're trying to do the best we can with what we are given, you know? And sometimes, and you know me, I'm going to push the envelope and push the button for sure. I might get one or two quick ones, but that's, you know, that's how the defenders adjust, you know, see what we can get away with and see what we can and adjust from there.
And I was just going to ask real quick, how important is that team defense? Because I don't think people realize how much y'all have to defend these days early in the shot clock. 1, 2, 3 actions early throughout the league. It's not just one or two teams. So how do you navigate that throughout a game? How important is that?
That's huge. And now the new gen and the new style of play is everybody's running up and down. You got a whole bunch of young kids in here that just run. You got Giannis coming downhill, Ja coming downhill with force. And it ain't going to be just one person that's going to be able to stop them. So you definitely got to load up, show bodies. You know, just make them get it out their hands and make other people, you know, make plays. But it's definitely a team defense. It's definitely team defense more than ever now in the league. I think so. You know, just being on a string and communicating is huge. But just to show bodies and to load up and just make it difficult. I think that's what you got to do nowadays.
I got you. I guess a couple of quick ones for me just on that end. When you're heading into a matchup, or what are some matchups that get you particularly excited? Like, I have to guard this player here. I really got to make sure I'm breaking my A game in this one.
No, it's starting to get every night now. there's a lot of teams, especially in the West. We see somebody every day in the West for sure. So it's just exciting. You know, one day it might be, you know, Ja. Next day, like yesterday, it might be marketing. So, you know, I just got to switch on. It might be, you know, big fella. I might be guarding the five, you know, tomorrow. And I don't know, whatever the coaching staff needs me to do, you know, I'm available and, you know, just playing off, you know, what they like to do. Just try to take away something they like to do. Some guys is just heavy post work like Jimmy do. And I play one-on-one with Jimmy. So he helps a lot when I got to have those type of matchups, whereas it's going to be one-on-one base game kind of. And then there's nights like yesterday where we got to load up on marketing and everybody, you know, helps me out, you know, by being in the right spot and, you know, not letting him get easy looks.
Got you. And I guess last thing for me, just to shift gears a little bit, as you are here representing the SBA.
A little bit. Yes, absolutely. Shout out to SBA, Royce Campbell, Sheldon Lewis, announced the skateboarding league SBA, and they gave me opportunity to come be a part of that and join that. And but them two, is they do all the heavy work. I'm just blessed to be able to help out and do everything I can. But they brought it to me, and I was like, growing up, you know, I have friends and stuff that skate and whatnot. I skated a little bit, but not nearly to this point where, you know, I can actually, you know, go out there and compete. But just for the love of the game, I mean, for the love of the culture in the skate world, playing skate, growing up, Tony Hawk Pro Skater, I think we've all played Tony Hawk. Mm-hmm. So, you feel me? So it's just like, it hits different, you know, and I'm sure this wasn't the first thought of like, why isn't there a skateboard league? You know, it was just, it's just sitting out there on the ground. Nobody, you know, picks it up and try to do something. So they came to me and was like, yo, we're trying to start a skateboard league. I was like, absolutely. Whatever I can do and be a part of to help that. It's been great in the last few years. Done a lot of hard work, a lot of long nights, meetings after meetings after meetings after pitches, you know, just trying to get this thing off the ground. And we finally did it this summer, getting off the ground, you know, announcing in Big Bear, you know, our upcoming season in combine and draft, which is excited. First co-ed league, professional league, men and women, equal pay. So, you know, to be able to do that and start something. So I don't even know what the word to use is. It's like unique, but it's just like, it's overdue, you know, it's way overdue, and it should have been here years ago, but I'm thankful and blessed to be a part of this with them and you know, to start this and create something, you know, for the skate culture.
I love that. Okay. Last official one from me. What was your favorite Tony Hawk game?
Oh, Project 8 for sure. Oh, what? Project 8 was live. I'm talking about live. You got to build up. You got to work. You got to make clips to get the sponsorships. Mm-hmm. And then once you get, you know, good enough, you get to pick, you know, where you want to go. I think I chose Girl Company. Okay. So that one was, I loved, Project 8 was probably my favorite for sure.
Okay, I love the way you lit up on that one.
Hey, no, Project 8, I wish they remastered Project 8, because they did remaster 1 and 2 and 3, I think. I downloaded that, but Project 8 was, it just hit different. I don't know, just for me, it was just the way they put it together and the way that you can choose where you wanted to go and, you know, go to spots and make clips. It was just, it was different at the time.
That's good stuff. That's good stuff. I need to see if they remade Underground. That was probably my one. But either way.
No, they did. They remade Underground 1 and 2. They just remastered it not too long ago.
I got to tap in.
And you know they got Skate. So, you know, Skate's the new Gen 1. Skate's is Skate. Skate's fire. Yeah, Skate's fire. But, you know, the classics is the classics.
Understood. Well, Gary, thank you again for rocking with us, tapping in, spending a little bit of your time. We really appreciate you.
No, I appreciate y'all. The Dunker Spot, that's a hell of a name right there. That's a hell of a, I like that a lot.
There we go.
Stay in that Dunker Spot. Yeah, absolutely. I appreciate you, fellas.
Appreciate you. Thank you.
All right.
Thank you once again to Gary Payton II for joining the show. Thank you once again for sending in those mailbag questions. And ultimately, Thank you for listening to and or watching this episode of the Dunker Spot Podcast. Please subscribe if you haven't already. We are on Apple, Spotify, RIP Google, Stitcher, Podbean, wherever you get your podcasts, you can find us. Subscribe to the Yahoo Sports YouTube channel. Great content all around. But for us, we're here every Tuesday and every Friday. So tap in, give us those likes, all that good stuff. You can catch me on socials at Nikias NBA. You can catch Steve on socials at Steve Jones 20. And with that, we will catch y'all next week.